I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things.
So that's how Martha Woodruff has started The Spark for about over 6 years here on WMRA, and that intro would always be followed by an interesting conversation. Well, today, hopefully, will be no exception, except for the fact that we're turning the tables and putting Martha in the guest's seat. I'm Matt Bingay, and I have the honors of being the interviewer. Martha agreed to be the interviewee. This is a special half hour here on WMRA as we mark the occasion when Martha Woodruff is finishing her work with us and moving on to becoming a full-time writer. She's retiring from public radio, but we did convince her to talk a bit before she walked out the door.
Are you nervous?
I've been thinking a lot about it, yeah. Yeah. Are you?
Of course. I'd rather have my hair set on fire.
Well, that's what I was thinking about beginning, actually, is the very fact that you agreed to do this.
Yeah.
Is, well, it goes against sort of what we are taught and what we celebrate in public radio. And so I want to first thank you for allowing our listeners to listen to a conversation about you. And point out that, yes, as public radio hosts, we don't do this. We don't put ourselves on the pedestal. We put our guests on the pedestal, which you have done that so well for so many people for so long that this must feel wrong.
I'm just blushing. Can we leave it at that? I haven't blushed in 50 years.
Okay, well, we'll move past this okay. And just straight into the conversation. I wanted to just kind of begin by asking you to give people a bit of a snapshot of sort of your life's roadmap. It's so colorful. Goes far beyond your start at WMRA. So you don't have to go into great depth, but I think just touching on some of the highlights on how you got to here.
Born and raised in Greensboro, North Carolina. And a very formative thing is that I was the child of agnostics, and it was the Bible Belt before church and state were separated. And I used to get prayed over in the second grade because I hadn't been to Sunday school. And I think that it really, really, truly developed a certain vein of independent thinking.
Did it strike you as a curious thing at the time?
Well, it was dreadful. I had to stand up, and the teacher led the entire class in prayer for my soul.
Wow.
And it's the sort of thing that either kills you or makes you stronger.
I have a hunch that there's many things you've encountered in life that were crucibles like that. And you ended up on the stronger side, I think, in almost every case,
or at
least you chose to go that path.
I ended up as I ended up. Anyway, I went to boarding school and 1 year of college in New England. Then I dropped out because I am more interested in living than studying about life, I think. And I came from a hyper-intellectual family. And I just wasn't that. So I took a bus because it was during a plane strike and went to Houston, Texas, where I ended up hanging out, doing a lot of theater, various odd jobs, getting married, having my daughter. Then came back up demonstrating against the war. And I was around Rice University with this one of those kind of golden groups of people who've all gone on to do fabulous things. And it was, golly, it was fun. It's fun to be young. I wouldn't go back, but it's fun to be young.
and then it's fun to look back on being
yes,
young.
Yes, and then I came to Charlottesville with my then husband. And in Charlottesville, I did restaurants and a lot of theater. And
can you set sort of where we are in time right now?
Early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And co-owned three restaurants in Charlottesville and did lots of theater. And then
one of those restaurants is still a going concern today. Yeah. Did you open and start Miller's?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Martha's Cafe.
Yes. And then
the
co-owned the Blue Moon Diner,
oh, okay.
which was just saved by the city council or something from being demolished. Yay, Charlottesville.
So yeah, you became known as a restaurateur.
I was a restaurateur and a theater person, and actually got into grad school in theater at UVA with no undergraduate degree. I'm a smooth-talking kind of person.
I do know this about you.
But I got into broadcasting there, too, because Dave Kupp, the longtime news director at Channel 29, the NBC affiliate, was a friend. We'd done a lot of theater together, and he used to come into the cafe, my then restaurant, and eat. And he was fussing once because he couldn't find, they had a talk show, and they couldn't find a host for the talk show. They just couldn't find it. They interviewed lots and lots of people. So when he was left, I said to my then husband, I could do that. And he said, you can't pull that off. So that was the red flag.
That was the only thing you needed to hear.
So I went in and I auditioned. And here's the deep, this is why I got hired. I have the great capacity for being able to look into the black hole of a camera without being discombobulated in the least. That's how I became a talk show host.
You could connect with the TV audience through a blank lens.
It didn't make me self-conscious, I guess. But the television wasn't really for me. You have to have hairdos.
you have to think about what you wear every day.
Yeah, and I can remember telling my crew just to shoot me from the waist up because I wasn't in proper, you know.
Right. Today's jeans.
But it was, I think that's where I fell in love with storytelling and with people's stories. I think my greatest, most useful talent is that I'm really curious. And I really love to hear people's stories. Each one of us is our own adventure. And we're the only ones who get to live that adventure. That's it. Nobody else gets to live it. And I love trying to understand what people are doing with their adventure. Does that make sense? And how they feel about it.
Learn about and experience and maybe even inform their own adventure.
Yes. Yeah, because we can broaden our scope by understanding each other's adventures and stories.
I was born to be telling this story. I could only be telling this story. I will always be telling this story.
Well, and then you entered the picture here at WMRA shortly after
No, actually, there was a time I moved to Winchester for a time. And
that's
where I came
into radio
at WINC, did a little, which was top 40 then. I think I did a little biweekly feature. I can't remember the name of it. But it was the first time I'd just gone out with a microphone. And my first one was, I went up in an ultralight and I didn't know anything about microphones. So you could hear and somebody shouting over the... over the back, but I mean, radio is it. And I met Wendy Kaufman, his longtime NPR person, at a party. And she started talking about NPR, which I didn't know about. This was the early 80s. But we got to talking about story, and she said, you should come work for us. I said, okay, I'm going up to NPR and work for them. And I kept badgering Jay Kernis, who was sort of god of programming back then. And he kept, and I'm good on the phone because I get on and off and I'm cheerful and I don't outstay my welcome and I get permission to try again, call back. So Jay, finally we discovered we both rock climbed, so Jay would see me. And I went in with lots of tape and he listened to it. It was an interview, kind of unedited, I didn't know what I was doing, with John Jackson, who's an old blues singer. And Jay, I'll never forget, he said, you're a brilliant interviewer, but you don't know anything technically. Go away and learn it. And I did. I went away and learned
it. Well, when you came to WMRA and first applied, you definitely pointed out that at that time you had experience as a freelance reporter for NPR. And then you told me one of my favorite stories about an interview you got with Paul Newman.
Okay. Paul Newman, the actor. was taking a break from movies to concentrate on race car driving, and he wasn't doing any interviews. And NPR wanted an interview with him as a race car driver. You know, I've never been kind of one to go through regular channels. So I called up his racing company with, I forget the name of his partners, and I made friends with the woman who answers the phone. And she put me through after a couple of conversations with Paul Newman's partner. You know, he said, well, come on up. You know, you can see what happens. So I drove up to Lime Rock Raceway, and I hung out with the crew, with Paul Newman's crew.
Mm-hmm. And so you became part of the scene.
As part of the scenery. And and then I got an interview. And I remember, you know, there was a huge pack of press people there, including this reporter from USA Today that I got to be friendly with. And I'll never forget when tall Paul came out of his trailer and motioned me forward, this guy saying, she's getting an interview.
Well, this was important. As I recall, it was a year that Paul said he wasn't doing any
interviews.
And you got to him through his pit crew, and you got the interview.
And the thing I remember, you know, he's famous for his blue eyes. And then, you know, and here he is, and there were the blue eyes. And I remember they talked. They're the only eyes I've ever been around who talked. And they said, you have 20 seconds to prove you're worth my time.
Whoa. I would say you have what we talk about often today as grit. You really do have that. It's not just that you're interested in people's stories, but you get them. But if we continue in this vein, I'll never get to the questions that our listeners have asked, which is one of the things we did. We sent out on Facebook, what would you like to know about Martha? So you've talked a bit about your life, and Kate Buford wanted to know.
Hi, Kate.
What changed your life once or multiple times? And she added, how your life now is shaped by those moments.
Well, I shy away from generalities, but I've never met anybody whose life hasn't had a crisis. And I am completely open about, I have two chronic illnesses. One is depression and one is alcoholism. And they collided in my 40s, and I call it my train wreck. And I essentially was sort of shipwrecked in my own life there for a while. There's a sense of when you're an addict and you're able to get sober, there's a sense of being rescued. It must be like something what people feel if they survive the Titanic, mm-hmm. you know, when so many people don't.
A close call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think what I came out of that with is a real enjoyment and appreciation for good days. That mm-hmm. every day that's a good day is a good day, and I'm not arguing with it.
Well, you had mentioned that you also are adept at going around the established channels.
Yeah.
And to use one of your very favorite words, I would posit that maybe that experience also taught you that you don't have to wait. You don't have to sit and play the game.
No.
There are other ways to do things, and that also time is precious. So why play the game?
Well, yeah. I'm not sure that didn't start with my childhood, because
okay.
I remember.
So it may have been there before?
Yes. Let me tell one quick story. I was at my parents. My dad made men's underwear, and my mother was a college professor, so they had interesting parties. And I can remember being at one of their interesting parties, and some adult, I was probably 8 at the time, asking me what I wanted to be when I grow up. You know, cute little girl, let's ask her what she wants to be when she grows up. And I thought, because, you know, I probably wanted to be the first woman baseball player at that point in the major leagues. But I said, well, I guess I'd like to grow up and have children. And my dad, not mad, but firmly swooped down on me and said, Martha, that is something that happens to you. That is not what you do with your life. And this was in the 50s. And that's pretty extraordinary.
That is not the depiction of the 50s that was in all mainstream
it
media.
I was not raised to see limitations.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just try it, and if you fail, so what?
So Becky Martinez Fitzgerald would like to know a little bit more about your acting career.
Oh.
And if maybe you have a good trip or adventure that you haven't published anything about.
Oh, probably not. my favorite acting story, I guess, which I have written about, when I was in Houston, and Robert Altman, who is now dead, but he did Brewster McCloud in the original MASH movie, mm-hmm. and he was in Houston shooting a movie, and he was on his way to do McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and he was casting for that. So I sent him my headshot, which probably some hippy-dippy friend has taken in the backyard, and my resume, I can't imagine what that was, and said, I am in a note saying, I am going to be your new star. And he phoned that afternoon. I had a, 6-month-old baby or 1-year-old baby. Robert Altman phoned that afternoon and said, come to a party. So off I went to a party, and there's Robert Altman, and we met and shook hands, and I was so naive. I was too naive to really know everything that was going on at that party. But Robert Altman said to me, would you like to go to Minnesota and shoot a movie? And I was pretty stunned, and I said, but I have a child. And he said, well, you've got to make up your mind right now whether you want to be in the movies or have a child. And I chose Lizzie, my daughter.
So you had a moment you were at a crossroads, even as aware of how large a crossroads you were at.
I'm sure I would have been one of the drugged out whores.
Oh. So, John Donne wanted to know which travels have had the greatest effect on you.
Oh, I am not an exotic traveler. And I grew up in a bubble, a middle-class, elitist, intellectual bubble. And when I first started freelancing full-time, I had a pickup truck with a camper, and I'd just drive around in this looking for stories. And I seemed to end up in West Virginia a lot. Mm. In these towns that were, they're dying coal mines, and they were towns, bleak towns that were sort of dumped into these hollers.
Mm-hmm.
And
you could miss if you didn't know they were there.
If you didn't know you were there, mm-hmm. you wouldn't go. And I met people who got me out of my bubble. For example, I was there doing some story on some sort of grassroots community center that some really impoverished town was trying to put together. And this young woman kind of followed me around like a puppy. And finally, we could talk for a minute. And she said, can I ask you something? And I said, sure. And she said, do you pay your own electric? And I said, well, yeah, I do. And she said, I've never met a woman who pays her own electric. And
that must have been a big eye-opener for you.
It was, that how different people's lives are. And it was a time when I remember becoming aware that my experience on paper might look pretty good, and I might look sophisticated, but I didn't know much.
Mm-hmm.
About
a lot more
human,
to this world than the experience you'd already had.
Yeah, than my safe little bubble. So I have such confidence that people are basically good and kind. For example, I was in Penn Station, I think, and catching a train, and I'd been, I think, up to ABC to interview Howard Cosell, which is not pleasant, and then back. And Howard Cosell.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was in the cookie line, and I wanted a cookie, and who knew there were like 18 different kinds of cookies, and I was tired. So the guy said, what do you want, lady? And I said, oh, God, I don't know. And the guy behind me said, I know what I want. And the man behind the cookie counter looked at me, and he said, lady, you take any cookie you want for free. And I thought, you know, just to have that at the end of a long, trying day, mm-hmm. being interviewing Howard Cosell, and that gesture, mm-hmm. people are nice.
Right, and it's the guy behind the counter you're more connected to than Howard Cosell.
Yeah.
Well, Lydia Wilson wanted to know how the creative process might be a little bit different for you, a person embedded in a place like WMRA. And she's specifically curious about writing, which you do quite a bit.
Yeah.
But she wanted to know if there is an interaction.
Oh, gosh, yes. I think I thanks to WMRA, I had a long run as a getting assignments and working with specific editors that became friends at NPR. Mm-hmm. And those editors taught me it's a rigorous, rigorous process. You can't take any shortcuts. You can't slough any thinking. And they taught me two things, how to drive a story, and also the hard part of writing is figuring out exactly what you want to say and then saying it clearly. The thinking is the hard part because I am enormously fuzz-headed in the normal everyday course of things. But when you're doing something that somebody else is going to be listening to, it has to be clear and specific. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Fiction, of course, is an imaginary world, but I don't think it can be imaginary to the writer. You know, you have to really be,
have to live in that world.
I have to live in that world to the extent that I miss my characters mm-hmm. when I finish and leave. So it is. There's a tremendous arc, and I don't think I would. I think I learned how to write doing NPR stories.
So Angela Carter wanted to know what's next, but she has an interesting follow-up, and I think that, frankly, to me, this is the more interesting question. If you could say something to yourself in the past, what would it be?
Get real. I wasted a lot of time before my train wreck living up to my own image of myself. Put a lot of energy into that. And wow, is that a waste of energy.
An image that wasn't necessarily true to who you are?
Well, it wasn't. It's not that it wasn't true to me. I just wasn't comfortable being, I had to grow into being comfortable with myself and into accepting the world as it really is. And, you know, and I spent a lot of time, what if only,
mm-hmm.
or trying to plan to control things I couldn't control, you know, yada, mm-hmm. yada, yada.
Right, right. So Brad Jenkins asked how you feed your curiosity and your creativity.
Wake up.
Just start
the day.
Wake
up and look around. And I love what I call first level conversations. It's like the person pumping gas next to you or
like
the person
first
behind
encounters.
The gas. Yeah. And just the richness of human interaction, that feeds my storytelling, I think.
Okay. Rebecca Dougherty wanted to know what's your favorite way to spend an hour that involves people, and maybe you just touched on it.
That or lunch.
Oh, yes.
Lunch.
You are famous for lunching.
I live to lunch.
Yeah. Katrina Dido said, you always seem so happy. And is this true or is this more of a front? And has this always been true? Because she added in parentheses, it has been as true as long as I have known you.
You know, even when I am a chronic depressive and an alcoholic, but the baseline, when those are not acting up, I can remember my mother calling me her optimist. I think I've just always pretty much enjoyed myself.
So it's your natural default setting.
I think so.
And as long as there isn't something acting on it or getting in the way.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, Katrina. It's always been true. We had quite a few people asking questions about your next book, which I know is one of the things that you are eager to concentrate on. It's one of the reasons you're doing your second retirement here at WMRE.
Yeah, can I say damn on the air? It's the working title is this damn second novel. Because it kind of goes back to what we said. I need to inhabit this world, and I keep thinking about Books and Brews and editing The Spark and stuff. And for somehow being published changed my capacity to just compartmentalize. But, you know, the last place I lived in Charlottesville was the Altamont Apartments, which anybody who knows Charlottesville, they were built in 1929, and they sit on the top of Altamont Circle. And my second novel is set there. It's rechristened the Bella Vista, and it's upgraded a little bit because it was built by but that building is actually part of the story. And it's a story of four people who are connected with the Bella Vista, one of whom is Agnes Tattle, who was the mother-in-law in Small Blessings, that seems to be the consensus favorite character because she doesn't take any grief off anybody.
So this is a continuation of sorts?
It's a continuation, but not a sequel.
Right. Well, thank you for spending the time. I want to say, I don't want to speak for anyone else, but for myself, you've done so much for me personally. My sense of place, my sense of where I live and who I live with is so informed by the work you've done here at WMRA. And I'm just so proud to have worked with you, Martha. And I'm tearing up. But I want to just say good luck, and we wish you nothing but success as you continue to work on life.
Well, I know you mean that to be the sign-off, but I want the last word, because I never stayed anywhere for more than 5 years, including my first two marriages, I'm sad to say. And this is an extraordinarily creative and kind work situation. And it is so tiny, and everybody who's here is so good. And the community around this place is, I mean, it's just become my home. And, you know, I'm a gypsy. I didn't ever expect to have that. And you hired me. So
so it's my fault.
I owe you, buddy.
Okay, I know Martha wanted to have the final word, but hey, I'm the interviewer here, so let me just add, the music you're listening to right now, she would always quote it in the New Orleans French, Laissez les bons temps rouler, which does translate as let the good times roll. So we're going out as a tribute to Martha and her spirit with one of her favorite sayings. And we all here at WMRA wish Martha Woodruff the very best as she pursues a career as a full-time writer. I know she would also like to say, if she was here to say it, thanks for listening.
Let the good times